All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fucksters? What's happening? It's me, Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. How's it going? Everything okay out there? How's the weather? It just had this massive cloudburst where I am. Where the sky just opens up with lightning and thunder and dumps massive amounts. I'm in New York. I'm inside. Thank you for your concern. I don't know where you're at, but that's where I am. Everything all right? I'm a little frenetic. I'm a little crazy. But I did the Tonight Show last night. I'm recording this after I did it, so I'm a little loopy, a little jumpy. I think it went pretty well. It's weird, you know. There's something about Fallon that I always like seeing him. He's a good listener. He's a good audience. He's always funny in the moment, and it was fun. Had a good time on the Tonight Show last night. Is that okay? I hope so. Today on this show, Alex Ross Perry is here, the film director. His most recent film, Her Smell, with Elizabeth Moss, is available on Apple, Amazon, and other on-demand digital platforms. He's made many other films. He's a real film nerd. We had a top-notch film conversation. He's a very bright guy, intense guy. He's got a frequency to him. That, you know, you feel it right away. It's good. It's focused. It's intense. It's smart. And yeah, I was in Chicago. A lot of things have happened. I'm heading home today after a lot of press for the movie Sword of Trust, which I want to tell you this Friday and Saturday night. I'll be at the New Art Theater in Los Angeles with Lynn Shelton doing a Q&A after the 7 p.m. screenings of Sword of Trust. We're now up to 65 theaters, folks. 65 theaters are going to be showing the movie this summer. It opens this weekend at Opera Plaza Cinemas in San Francisco, Shattuck Cinemas in Berkeley, E Street Cinema in Washington, D.C., Tiff Bell Lightbox in Toronto, Kendall Square Cinema in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and the Jacob Burns Film Center in Pleasantville, New York. And it just added the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington, New York, and the Nighthawk Prospect Park in Brooklyn. Go to swordoftrust.com to find out when the movie is coming out near you. It's worth it. This movie's been getting crazy press. I don't mean to go on about it, but I got to be honest with you, folks. I had no idea. I had no idea when you make a little movie like this. Like, I wasn't even sure it was going to get done. But, you know, Lynn is like the real deal, so of course it got done. But you put a little movie out this into the world, and you don't know what's going to happen with it. It's getting so many reviews, so much press. It's crazy. I'm very excited about it, but it's not that I had low expectations. I had no expectations. So it's all pretty exciting. And the screening at the Music Box in Chicago, the first show was sold out. It was like 700 people. And just to dip into that theater to watch a movie where it's a comedy, obviously, but 700 people laughing at the same time to the point where they're missing lines is such a, it's so exciting and so rewarding. I got to be honest with you. You know, I'm just thrilled with it. And I also want to tell you, please, if you can, go see it at a theater. Now, I don't know where some of these theaters are, and I don't know how populated the theaters are, but I think you'll probably have a better experience even if you're in a movie theater with five people. But I guess if you're really thinking about that way, when it comes out streaming, you could probably invite five people over, maybe your family and a couple other people. But the experience of watching a movie, how they're supposed to be watched communally with a bunch of strangers, sharing in that event, in that moment, in that laughter, is really the way to do it. All right? And can I just say that to you? So what else did I do in Chicago? I ate pizza. I did a bunch of press. Hung out with my buddy Joe Swanberg. Yeah, you can watch me on, you know, in the last season of Easy, which he directed. And I believe Glow is coming on soon, right? August 9th, I think. The third season of Glow drops. So that's happening. You get to see a more svelte Sam Sylvia. I'm not going to tell you too much about it, but I'm excited that that's going up. You know, you wait a long time for these things, man, right? The other thing I did, which I meant to talk to you about the other day, was that when I was here last week in the city, my friend Lynn Shelton, who I've been doing all these dates with, you know, her friend Heidi Schreck, is the creator of the show, What the Constitution Means to Me. It's on Broadway. And I got to be honest with you people, and I think some of you sense this, but I've had some sort of, slow but steady mind shift around things. There is a lot of education that is going into my brain that I didn't have framed properly, or I didn't know, or I didn't think about, or I wasn't sort of really sensitive to or aware about. And it's happening. You know, things are going into my mind where things that I once thought were normal were undeniably fucking, incorrect. And it's exciting. It's an exciting process. And seeing this play, I don't know if you know about it. It's basically, it's sort of a one woman show, but it's her character, which is her, Heidi. She was a debater, a high school debater, and she used to tour with doing debates. She would save money from winning debate contests to go to college, and she would debate, the Constitution, things about the Constitution. So this whole angle of the show was her going back to some of her arguments and some of the subject matter of her high school debates and reframing him into current culture, around equality, equal pay, equal rights, and just the reality of how the Constitution came to life, what the Constitution means, who does it represent, when was it written, all these stuff sort of woven into the narrative of a woman talking about the evolution of the Constitution, seeking, theoretically to protect all people, but falling a little short when it comes to women and people of color and marginalized people. And I know it was a weird kind of reaction that I had when I was told about the show, because it sounds like, What the Constitution Means to Me, it's like, oh man, it sounds like a class. I don't want to go learn. And I was really resistant to it. But eventually I buckled, and I was like, all right, Lynn knows what she's talking about. She knows this woman. She'd seen the show. She said it was surprising. I'm going to be moved. It's going to be interesting. You think you know things. And I've been talking about this a bit on stage. I don't know what I really know or how I know it. I make assumptions. I understand, what the Constitution is and why it's important and some of the fundamentals of it and, why it's necessary. But what do I really know about it? I don't know about history. I just kind of plug along, having a fundamental understanding that it's an important document. But just like everything, I just glean things. I did not get a good education. Not because it wasn't offered to me, but to get quite honestly, I don't think I was paying attention. And I really sort of envy the people that kind of dug into high school, got hold of civics, got hold of how government works, got hold of American history, put it into context, did their studying, did their homework, and at least had a foundation for some of that basic understanding. I didn't get it because I wasn't paying attention, because I didn't give a shit, because I was spaced out, because I just couldn't focus, because I was feeling so awkward and uncomfortable. All I really cared about was feeling not awkward and uncomfortable, hanging out with my friends. Like, when I think back on high school, I know I had a locker, I knew it was packed with books, but I don't remember ever going to it. I don't remember ever using it. I don't remember doing homework. I don't remember, learning much of anything. And, it's a liability. I feel guilty and shitty that I don't know these basic things. So when I saw a show like What the Constitution Means to Me, it was a powerful kind of personal story that, framed it from a woman's point of view and talked about other situations she had been in, situations other women had been in where they should have been protected and ultimately weren't. But it was also really an education in what the Constitution means. And look, I know it's an important thing, and I know it's what holds us together and what the country is based on. I don't know the nuances. And they hand out a little pocket constitution while you're there. And it really, because of the emotional resonance of her story and what she has, I don't know how she does this show every night, because she's got to go kind of deep in herself every night to access these emotions, which is really another thing I learned is that, I can go up and do my stand-up and I can kind of dig in, but, how deep does that really go? How much do I have to offer myself? And when you really start to think about, or when I start to think about acting and really showing up to perform with a full range of emotions, the job is you know, getting in that, getting down there, digging deep for it, and being able to have control over getting there every night. So go see it if you can. It should be required. I know a little more about the Constitution, and I've got a pocket Constitution with me, and maybe I'll dig in. Maybe I'll dig in, and maybe we'll start having specific discussions about the Constitution. No, we won't. We're not going to do that. But I have the, it's available to me now. All right? That's all I'm saying. All right? Did I tell you I saw my dad? I did. He came back. You know, he came back in. Him and his sister and my dad's wife came back in to watch the entire movie. I think I told you that they came in late because they had problems with trains. But they came back in, and I promised I would take them out. And it's another weird thing about whatever's happening to my heart lately is that, you know, look, I don't have any real outstanding beefs with my old man, and, you know, and I accept him for who he is, but I don't really see him that much. And somehow or another, that distance doesn't bother me maybe as much as it should. I don't feel like I need to. But, you know, he came to the show, and, you know, he's 80, man. He's 80. And he, you know, he enjoyed the movie. And then I decided I'd take them all out to Russ and Daughters Cafe for some straight-up Jew food. And I knew he would enjoy it. And, you know, he's having a little trouble walking. And, you know, he's not as sharp as he used to be. And it's just, it's really a kind of moving and sad thing to realize, like, if you don't see your parents enough, especially if they're alive and you're old. I'm a middle-aged man, and my father's now an older man, old man. You don't see them enough. Some part of your brain really holds them in a place where they really aren't anymore. They kind of stay your what you knew them as, your dad, you know, when you're younger, and, you know, the vitality of who they were, and you know, the part they played in your life, whether it was bad or good, a little of both with me. You know, no matter what distance I feel like I have from the guy, you know, when I took him out to eat, you know, I sat next to him, I put my arm around him, and, you know, and I made sure he got what he wanted. He understood what was going on. I wanted him to have a nice food. I asked him how it was. You know, I know what he likes, so I made sure that he tasted everything, and you know, and I helped him get up out of the booth and helped him walk outside. But it just, like, man, it really hit me, man. You know, it just really hit me. You know, not so much that my dad's old, but that, you know, I love him, and that he, you know, he made me, you know, for better or for worse, and I really got to see him more, and I really got to talk to him more, because I don't know how much time he's got left. I don't know how much time I got left, and I don't know that it's always going to be a great time, but it doesn't matter, you know. It doesn't matter. It's only going to happen once, and he's my only dad, and I was happy I saw him. And I don't know why I wanted to tell you guys that, but really, just, you know, make sure you reach out to your folks if they're still around, because they're your folks no matter what you think. And, you know, I'm amazed that I'm saying this, because I've gone through periods in my life where that wasn't necessarily how I felt. You know, I felt like, you know, fuck it, once or twice a year is enough. I can only handle about an hour. That may be true. I may only be able to handle about an hour or two, but, you know, I should make them happen as frequently as I can. That's all I'm saying, and maybe you should think about that too. All right? All right? Show up for your folks. That's the new Mark talking there. Wow. Wow. I can't believe it. I don't know what's happening to me, man. I think I'm getting old. So my guest here now is I was excited to talk to him. I was a little nervous because he's intense, and he's very focused, and he's very smart, and he's a great director. Alex Ross Perry has a movie out, his most recent movie, has several movies out, is a film called Her Smell, which I actually was asked to audition for. It's with Elizabeth Moss. It's a rock and roll movie. It's available on Apple, Amazon, and other on-demand digital platforms. If you've seen the movie, I was supposed to read for the Eric Stoltz part, though I think he did a very good job. So this is me and Alex Ross Perry talking back in the garage. So now, how is that a song? Do you tell?
Perfect. I mean, I know this tea very well.
You do?
Yeah. Well, just
this particular one?
Harney and Sons, yeah.
Harney and Sons, yeah. They're a good one. They're like a...
As we both sip.
Yeah, but they're... Well, I don't meet many
tea guys, and I'm relatively new to it. Like within the last year or two, I quit drinking coffee, but now because of my compulsive disposition, like I'm way into the tea thing. Like I travel with bags of loose tea.
Yeah, I probably have traveled with it if I'm away for long enough. It also makes good iced tea.
Oh yeah, I mean, but I travel with several different kinds in bags. I travel with my strainer, and now I've got a travel kettle.
I'd like that.
There's a kettle you can get. I'll show it to you.
I'd like to get there. I don't have anything like that, but I'll bring it sometimes. Yeah, they gave us a lot of good tea on the movie.
They sponsored which movie?
On Her Smell.
Harney's was a...
Yeah, I think they're thanked in the credits as, you know, something like product placement. Product placement on independent film is kind of the secret weapon that people can utilize for their own gain. You can just write to them and to any companies.
Yeah.
Send them a packet with stills of the actors, a little description of the movie. You can get thousands of dollars worth of things that either is for the crew to eat or sometimes you put them in a scene. Even Apple does this. Well, there's this whole production design network in New York of people that you can get.
And what about money? Do they give you money?
No, never.
Oh, but you get cool shit. Sure.
I
didn't notice the Harneys in the movie.
I don't think it made it in. I think that was specifically said that was just for me. But you know, you put it, there is a scene in the movie where she makes a cup of tea.
Yeah.
Who's to say that it's not Harney and Sons?
Well, Harney's would be because they sent you some and they're watching it and they're like, "That I don't see any."
It's true, and yet it's the only product we were sent that I'm talking at length about on the record.
I know, and we're doing it. I'm dragging it out of you.
No, I still have a few of the tins that they sent me. It's more just I like tea as a ritual.
Sure.
Like, I like it because it's delicious and it helps me stay focused, but I really like the ritual of brewing it and kind of timing it.
Yeah, I dig that. I mean, I'm the same with coffee. Like, when I drink coffee, I got a way of doing it. I grind it fresh, you know, and I've got a few different delivery systems.
Yeah.
French press, cone. Whatever.
All stuff I don't relate to as a non-coffee drinker, but...
When did you make that decision? When did you
I've
draw the
line?
I've
never drank coffee. I mean, I've tasted it, but...
You seem like a guy that is... I'm projecting, but you might have decided that you're going to stay away from a lot of things.
I have stayed away from a lot of things, yes. To me, coffee just is like... That's the smell of waking up to go to school. My dad has a cup of... There's coffee in the house.
Uh-huh.
It's 6:30. I have to get up and
so
go to school.
Conditioned.
A Pavlovian miserable smell for me.
Where'd you grow up?
In Bryn Mawr, outside of Philadelphia.
Oh, so that's near Philly?
Yeah, 30 minutes away.
I like Philly.
Yeah, it's really nice. I came to appreciate it a lot as soon as I moved away.
Yeah, I think it's one of those cities where they did some work and it turned around somehow.
Weirdly, yeah.
But like, I go to DeNick's for the
you like the pork with the broccoli on it.
Yeah, pork rob at DeNick's at the Reading Station,
Reading Market.
Like, I'll go out to John's too, but that's the original. But I don't like. I prefer DeNick's.
Yeah. I never ate that before I became vegan when I was 18. I never had the DeNick's pork, but I tried all the cheesesteaks around town. And
before you became vegan?
Yeah.
Was that what compelled you?
No. It was just health, family, cholesterol scares that kind of...
I have that too.
My dad's...
You have genetic cholesterol?
Kind of. My dad's dad died like suddenly and weirdly young. Like he was 68, 69. Oh. And from some heart cholesterol thing. And then at that time, my dad got a cholesterol test and was told at the age of, you know, late 40s, 50 something, you really need to change the way you eat and live. You don't eat terribly. You know, he's not like a big fat guy who eats bacon and eggs every morning, you know, goes for a bike ride every day.
Yeah.
But he was told you just have really terrible cholesterol. And at the age of 50, had to change his diet. And I just thought
Is he vegan?
No, but he, you know.
Takes the pills?
I don't know. I don't know if he takes any.
Do you?
No.
Huh.
But he just, I just kind of thought, I don't want to be 50 and be told, even though you think you're healthy, you're not.
Well, you know, it's going to happen at some point, Alex.
I hope not. I hope
something's going to happen.
Something will.
Don't want to burst your bubble.
I know, but I've done everything I can by not having anything with cholesterol.
Have you had it tested?
My cholesterol?
Yeah.
Yeah, I got a blood test on a couple years ago.
All right.
Yeah, they said it was like as low as a 4-year-old's cholesterol.
Oh.
Because I haven't, you know, cholesterol is only an animal product, so I haven't eaten any of it in 16 years.
Huh. Yeah, I mean, I tried to do it with just diet, and mine's not high, but it's borderline. But eventually, I was just sort of like, fuck it, I'll take a pill every once in a while. I exercise, and I'll take the statin.
Yeah.
I'll take the statin.
Yeah, I
haven't felt any. You don't have to.
I'll get to the pills at some point.
You don't have to.
But
you don't take any vitamins?
No.
Just a tea?
Yeah, as much tea as possible.
So growing up there, like, what'd your old man do?
He worked in radio. which is a big...
So you grew up in show business.
Well, if you can call it
was
that.
Was he on the production side?
Before I was born, he was a DJ.
Really?
In Philadelphia radio.
Like music DJ?
Yeah. Mm. Which meant when we grew up, you know, the thousands and thousands of records in the house, which was always
you
nice.
Did have them?
Yeah, he just like 2 months ago sold them all.
Like as an estate almost?
I mean, he's
like,
just finally moving and needed to get rid of them. But, you know, we had in our basement just like one wall that was floor to ceiling records.
That's so good.
But yeah, he worked. And by the time I was, you know, aware of his job, he worked in the advertising side of it.
Uh-huh.
For this Philadelphia conglomerate that owns 4 or 5 stations.
Uh-huh. Not Clear Channel, before Clear Channel.
Yeah, just called Greater Media Philadelphia.
And they're probably Clear Channel now.
Something like that. They got bought out a couple years ago, which is why he doesn't work there or at all anymore.
And what about your mom?
She was at home.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Are they still married?
They're not.
Mm. But they're both around.
Yeah, they're both in the Philadelphia area.
And you got siblings?
Yeah, I have a much younger sister.
From your dad?
Well, from both of them.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They only split up like 5 years ago.
Oh,
like,
really?
Yeah, like so long after I'd stopped.
You didn't have to choose who to live with or anything.
No. I mean, I hadn't really seen them together, been home in years when they told me this was happening.
Yeah, that happened to me too. Like I guess I was in my 30s maybe.
Yeah, I was probably like 29 or 30 when I got a call right after Thanksgiving that they had.
It's funny, at that age, you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I wasn't really speaking to my mom or sister much at that point.
Really?
I just wasn't going home. And
you know, you mean not because
I mean,
of problem?
For, no, I mean, there's problems. Everyone has problems.
Sure.
It's kind of weird for families to assume that they'll be like a family who never has some weird problem.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was just kind of like, okay, well, tell me what I can do. And now I'm the executor of both of their wills.
Yeah, of course. How old is your sister?
Like I would say maybe 26 or 27.
But you're the one in charge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm the one who, you know,
yeah,
has a job and
you're you know, and you're talking to your mom again.
Yeah, a little bit. That started happening again kind of after they split up.
That's weird. I don't often hear the dude's issue with moms on that level. Like for me it's always dad. So like there's part of me that's sort of like, wow, you got that mad at your mom. That must have been pretty intense.
Oh, yeah, very intense. I mean, it's overbearing Jewish mother is hard for someone like me that doesn't like overbearing people at all. It was just a lot.
Well, you seem like a fairly earnest and open man. And I'd imagine if the overbearingness could be kind of obliterating.
Yeah, it's too much.
You got pushed back.
Like, I can't, like, a call every week, like, how's it going? I need to call you and complain about something. I just was eventually like, I can't pick up the phone and listen to a 25-minute rant once a week about, like, someone at the store that pissed you off today. Like, I just don't need this in my life.
It's exhausting.
Yeah, it's exhausting.
But it's not, in terms of transgressions, it's minor.
It's very minor. That's why everything's fine now.
Yeah.
But yeah, I really loved going to the radio station with my dad. And
yeah.
The kind of fun part of it was, you know, he had this weirdly just unrestricted access to Philadelphia area concerts.
So you went...
To everything. I mean, for free, from
when you were a little kid.
Like teenage
years. Was music always your thing?
Kind of. When I was a teenager, it certainly was very important, especially because I could go to 2 or 3 concerts every week.
And you're in your late 30s?
I'm 34.
So that was like, who were the people?
Like the first concert I ever went to was Stone Temple Pilots.
That's all right.
And then the next one was Bush and Veruca Salt. Now Veruca Salt are very important for this new movie.
Yeah.
Like a lot of, at that time, just modern alternative rock.
Yeah.
And then through that, like, you know, within the next 5 years, got very into 80s and 90s and then 70s punk just by working backwards from the influences of bands I was listening to.
Well, you know, you use that pop cover that's sort of like a kind of essential pop cover, the Only One song.
Yeah, yeah. So
Another
that,
Girl,
like,
Another Planet. Like, it's very specific.
And to me, like, I know that from The Replacements.
Right. The Replacements covered it. Yeah.
And I, you know, then I learned that they cover. I learned about the Only Ones, and now I like them. And the Replacements are one of my all-time favorites. And
sure.
Through them, you can. It's just kind of like started with what was on the radio.
Yeah.
Which I listen to a lot. Both.
But it's still kind of an esoteric cover. It, like, you know, it's,
well, some people think it's a Blink-182 song.
Oh, did they cover it as well?
Yeah, which I didn't know.
Yeah.
I know this is a very famous Replacements sloppy cover. And I guess in like 2004 or 5, long after I would have been paying attention to anything like that, Blink-182 did a similarly well-known cover.
Well, I came to power pop later. There's a whole world of that ilk of music that you know, when I was in the, you know, in the early 90s, it wasn't popular at all, really.
There was never a popular part of it. There was not like the band that put it on the map.
Right.
It was all like, it was always something that.
And it was their best song, I think, really. I mean, I've listened. The only ones have a couple albums, I believe.
Yeah, not many. I really love a song of theirs called People of Today.
Oh, yeah, that's a good song.
That's a really good song.
Yeah. So, like, let's go back, though. So you're a music kid and you're Jewish. And how Jewish?
100%.
No, I mean, but did you?
I had a bar mitzvah.
Oh, so you're middle class.
Middle class, like
Jew,
reform.
Right. Oh, reform? Not conservative? Reform.
No, not at all.
Guitar player in the synagogue?
No.
Okay.
Piano,
good.
Maybe?
Oh, really?
I don't remember. Stained glass? Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, like Jewish enough that we would celebrate high holidays, not much else.
Mm-hmm.
I had a bar mitzvah, which kind of became an infamous event.
Infamous to who?
To my family and uh-huh. to my synagogue.
Yeah.
And, you know, like my wife is from Oregon. She never met a Jew until she moved to the East Coast.
Well, was she surprised?
I think so. I mean, I wasn't there for it, but I think she was pretty shocked. But like, you know, in contrast to that, I spent
two years.
You're
not like they explain Jews to be.
No, she didn't have any clue. I wasn't the first one she met.
Yeah.
But you know, I spent 2 years at a bar bat mitzvah every single weekend.
Sure, of course.
But mine, you know how like—
Were they competitive?
Sometimes. I mean, you had to clear the dates. It really is.
No,
like,
but I mean like you know, who had the better
party? Oh, in
terms
of spending the
most money?
Yeah. Yeah, probably. Uh-huh. I mean, you know, my town wasn't, I mean, I come from the main line, so
sure.
there are very rich people.
Yeah.
And then there's kind of one tier down, which is more like my part of town.
Yeah.
But you know how at a bar mitzvah, after the sort of ceremonial Torah reading, mm-hmm. the child can give a speech?
The Haftorah and then the speech.
Like
yeah.
a little speech
sure.
on the topic of their choosing?
Yeah.
Until my bar mitzvah, this was allowed to be something that was unproofed and unsupervised.
Uh-huh.
Like you could just write it yourself and bring it in.
Yeah.
And I was so into like, at that time, just like, you know, just watching comedy on TV and like just being a bratty asshole.
Yeah.
And I like wrote this speech about how disappointing it is in life to be served with something like a bar mitzvah that is robbed of its ceremonial meaning and just becomes like 6 months of extra homework.
Yeah.
And I drew this long comparison to like getting like chocolate sprinkles and having a rainbow one in the sprinkles.
Uh-huh.
And how the rainbow one is the bar mitzvah.
Uh-huh.
And like my parents just describe looking out at my family and just like jaws on the floor. And then the rabbi.
Lenny Bruce is on the pulpit.
I was so proud of myself. I'd also broken my hand 2 days before.
Yeah. So you had a cast.
Yeah. And the rabbi put his hand on my shoulder and essentially said, "We failed to teach you the meaning of this."
He did?
Yeah.
Out loud?
Yeah. In front of everybody. And yeah, and then after that, everyone at my synagogue had to have their speeches read in advance by the rabbi.
The vetting process.
Yeah. So that was kind of the end of my relationship with the temple.
But also a nice metaphor. Like, you know, you could see early on that you had a sort of visual thinking and, you know, poetic, you know, the sprinkles analogy.
Yeah.
I think that's what it's going to be known as. The famous sprinkles analogy.
So then
analogy.
Like, you know, the sign-in board at the party.
Yeah.
Like dozens of people just wrote like sprinkles on it. But yeah, that was kind of the end of me and my relationship with the temple.
Yeah. It was the beginning of your provocateur career.
Of realizing I could entertain people by being obnoxious.
That's an important lesson to learn. But you didn't go into comedy. I did.
Yeah, no, it kind of wasn't, like public speaking wasn't that fun.
Yeah, no, it's notoriously not fun.
Yeah.
But did you ever do stand-up?
No. Like I was, the other day actually, one of the actresses from Her Smell, Ashley Benson, was on the Tonight Show with Fallon. And I went, because I just love talk shows. So like I would just watch.
Which one's she?
She's Roxy in the Acre Girls.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
She's
yeah.
the blonde one.
Okay,
she's
yeah.
in Spring Breakers.
Yeah, yeah.
And I went because I've always loved TV show tapings. And when I was a kid, I would just watch, you know, Letterman and Conan and Craig Kilborn every night.
Yeah.
And I went and I was like, all I ever wanted when I was growing up was to work with someone who would be on the show promoting something. I never wanted to be on a show. I never wanted to sit on TV and like have makeup on.
Not even in the 70s?
I wasn't around then.
No, I know. But like, it seems like there was a time where people of your ilk, you know, because you're a thoughtful, Semitic artist
that's true.
who obviously can talk, but like, you know, you're the kind of like a good Cavett guest.
Yeah, you mean like Cassavetes and Ben Cazzara and
sure,
Peter
man.
Falk like, promoting but, husbands yeah, but, and just, yeah, that would have been.
Back when that type of person was actually on talk shows a lot.
I guess maybe, yeah. Well, I didn't know this at the time. I guess yeah. when I saw that stuff later, I thought that looks fun.
Yeah.
But all I ever wanted was to just like go to a taping where someone's promoting something I worked on.
Were they promoting the movie?
Yeah, yeah. She was there to show a clip of her smell. And
you know, I was up for a part in that.
You mentioned this.
And you didn't know it.
I mean, you get these massive lists.
Sure, I know casting,
and then
yeah.
it's like, are you interested in people on this list? And I say yes. And then it goes, okay, well, actually, three of these people are unavailable. And I think that's where
it happened.
That's where we terminated.
Because like when I get it, this is the sort of the drop off between, you know, you, the director of the movie and the writer, and, you know, what I got. Like, you know, basically what I got was like, this movie's yours to have.
That's what they said to you.
Yeah.
It really needed me to have meetings with actors and explain stuff to them.
Yeah. Well, let's go back before we get to this movie. So you don't do comedy, and you know, when did the interest in film? Because I think you're a very unique filmmaker with a real control of the craft in the sense that, you know, I've watched three of your films and they all, you know, they're all unique, but you know how to control the look you're looking for.
Yeah. So my high school had a TV station in the basement.
Yeah.
That was the cable access for our township.
Oh, yeah.
And when I was in middle school, all I wanted to do was get there. Like, there were these guys that had a show called Tele Grande.
Yeah.
And they were on when I was like in eighth and ninth grade. And
grown-ups?
No, they were juniors and seniors.
Yeah.
So yes, grown-ups
yeah.
to me at the
yeah,
time.
Yeah, right.
And all I wanted to do was get to that TV studio in the basement and just hang out with these guys who wore, you know, jackets with punk patches on them and
yeah.
just learn from them.
Right.
And then as soon as I got to high school, I was in the TV studio every day after school until I graduated. And my friends and I eventually had our own show all of our junior and senior year. Like, we got the
So you were learning how to cut and produce?
Like shooting on VHS,
uh-huh.
Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, editing until 6 or 7 at night, and then the show goes out every Thursday.
Yeah.
And we were in it, and we would make little videos and little kind of pieces and
so it's hands-on.
Yeah, all day, you know, and that was all I really cared about.
There was no grown-up oversight?
There was one woman named Nikki Comstock who ran the studio, and because she wasn't a teacher,
mm-hmm.
so she didn't work like 8 to 3.
Right.
She worked 9 to 5 or 10 to 6, so we could stay really late with her.
Right.
And she was really instrumental. She just let us do our thing, and that was hugely important. And then I watched these other people graduate and go to film school.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, I didn't know you could do that.
Right.
You can keep doing this. You can just go to another place with a room in the basement and shoot stuff with your friends. And yeah, I mean, I did it for years. I just was down there shooting every day and making these silly little...
Were you going out in the world and doing it and yeah, bringing like, it back in?
Yeah, we would go around and like, you know, go to our houses, go to the mall, go around town.
Did you do any of the stop action stuff? People driving around on their butt?
No. Okay. Driving around on their butt?
Well, you know, where you kind of like, you know, people act like they're in a car and you do the frame by frame thing.
Oh, well, I did like little stop motion-y things at home with the video camera my dad bought me, which actually is the camera we shot the video flashbacks on in Her Smell.
Really?
And I would move Sculpey figures around.
So you had that thing and, you
know. Sony Hi8 Handycam, yeah.
And you, like, you kept hold of that in case you would need it?
I mean, this is the way my dad's house is. That's why he's getting rid of all of his records from the 80s now.
So he's a pack rat?
Kind of,
the cool stuff.
Which I've inherited. And then, this time last year before the shoot, I just texted him. I said, is that camera still around? And he said, yeah. And I said, can you overnight it to us? I think I need it for the movie. And then, yeah, there's images in there from the camera that I got for Hanukkah in, like, 1997.
Those are the ones where you shot them in the past with the gold record and
whatnot. Yeah.
So when you go, so you went to NYU.
Yeah. So I went from, so then I was in Bryn Mawr and then NYU was next.
And was that sort of, when did you, cause it seems like, you know, you have pretty specific heroes, you know, around, you know, film and literature and how you want to present stuff. I'm always sort of, it's always interesting to me to see how independent filmmakers that surface, you know, the choices they make, you know, what they're based on, you know, because like, you know, you said you're staying over at Jeff and Aubrey's house, Jeff Baena, who I know, he's another guy that makes sort of very there's a vision in place that, you know, like I watched Queen of the Earth and I'm not a stick in the mud. I'm not a prude, but I don't know what happened at the end. And, you know, that's your decision.
Fair.
But I understand the poetry of it and what you choose to put on and what you, you know, what you choose to show and what you choose not to show in terms of constructing a story. So I guess my question is, when you were at NYU, what was really kind of putting your personal visual framework together, an intellectual framework?
Yeah, I mean, even before that, do you remember in 1998 when the AFI Top 100 list first came out?
Yeah, kind of.
That was very important because through that, it was because of that that I watched Clockwork Orange and Blue Velvet.
I just watched that on a screen again in England.
Clockwork Orange?
Yeah, new print.
I just saw it in New York on a print a couple weeks ago for the 50th time.
It must be out, right,
time.
Yeah.
It's one of my top 10 favorite movies of all time.
So Clockwork Orange and what was the other one?
Blue Velvet, which were both on the AFI Top 100.
Really, those two?
Well, those are just the ones that I remember seeing that blew my mind the most as a 13-year-old.
Oh, okay.
So then I just got into, you know...
That list gave you the sort of primer to being a film head.
Yeah, right. And then I tried to work my way through it, but I look at those movies and I think, I need to see everything else by this filmmaker. And my dad had been a huge Twin Peaks fan, and when I got into Blue Velvet, he said, a guy I work with at the station has all the videotapes he taped off of TV of Twin Peaks, which you can't see anywhere else right now.
Right.
It's like 97, 98. Right. And then, you know, just so I was kind of getting into that very, you know, 101 stuff.
But what, in looking at like the way you work, I mean, I wouldn't have sourced anything that I've seen of yours to those two influences. What was it about those two directors that you in retrospect find compelling?
Well, they just gave me the idea, you know, very common that there's some filmmakers that you can look at a movie and within 2 seconds know who made it.
Okay.
That was very important. So then by the time I was at NYU, you know, like a lot of people who are 20, I was just became obsessed with French New Wave. And if it was on...
Yeah, I can see that.
If it was on Criterion, I had to have it.
Yeah.
If it was playing at Film Forum, I had to go see it.
Sure.
If it was at Anthology Film Archives or MoMA, I had to go see it.
And so then you were going, you suddenly were running around.
Suddenly I became just omnivorous. And I worked at Kim's Video at the time.
On 8th?
Yeah, on St. Mark's.
Yeah.
St. Mark's in between second.
I remember that place.
Yeah, the three
yeah,
floors.
There's three floors, and you're like, what's being sold on this floor?
Yeah.
Like, where do I rent? Why is it so confusing here?
Rent on the top floor.
Yeah.
I worked on the middle floor with DVD sales and vinyl
until
vinyl moved downstairs to the music. But just omnivorous. I mean, I would go see a double feature of B Westerns at Film Forum, go to work for 8 hours at Kim's, take a sexploitation movie home or a 70s horror movie home and watch that and then get up the next day, go to class.
So what do you think you took from, like, you know, if you're focusing on the new wave, like in terms of how it affected your particular vision, you know, what was it about those films and those guys?
I mean, you know, when you see those images, when you're discovering beyond like the top five movies,
like
you see 400 Blows and you're like, this is a masterpiece.
You
I get
Breathless
it.
And you
and then like two or three
Jules
years
and Jim
and I'm moved emotionally by these, and they're literate and they're smart and they're funny and they're human and then, but then, you know, a couple years later after 400 Blows, you see these other Antoine Dwinell movies, and all I ever wanted was to like make a movie like Bed and Board or Stolen Kisses, like, this adult boy stumbling through his romantic life and he can't get it together. And just, I mean, I must have watched those two movies a dozen times each when I finally got to them. And just seeing Leod just be this kind of, you know, lithe physical actor who's also smart and he's reading philosophy in bed. Yeah, I was just like, this is fantastic.
Right. So that's what informed you, is that, you know, that there is this sort of French intellectual way of life.
Yeah.
That you don't like that. I think that a certain type of American kid aspires to, but it's a very specific thing.
Of course. And it's, you know, the men and the women are both gorgeous. Everyone in the movies is beautiful. The photography is just simple and elegant, and it seems smart, but they're also, you know, so rooted in the history of other movies, which makes sense if you're me and you're watching three things a day. And yeah, and then like you go deeper and you go beyond those guys and you end up watching all the Romero movies and all the Rivette movies. And now I'm just at retrospectives all the time and like hanging out with people from Kim's, and we're just seeing movies together and
talking about
and just talking and then going out and drinking a lot. before I stopped doing that as well. And just, I don't know if you know Anthology Film Archive.
Sure.
I mean, that's what.
I think it's still going.
Oh, absolutely.
Like on second or
yeah,
third?
Yeah, second and second.
Yeah, second and second.
No, they just kind of raised a bunch of money for an expansion.
Oh,
but
great.
I lived one block away from there in my NYU dorm.
Yeah.
And they have the Essential Cinema series where, yeah, if you haven't seen Brackage projected or you haven't seen Michael Snow Wavelength projected.
Wavelength, right.
Yeah, you walk right in, and if you have a membership, the Essential screenings are free. And I could see prints of all these movies one block from my dorm and then, you know, go to Film Forum and watch East of Eden.
Yeah.
And that to me makes sense as a perfect day.
Right.
So I was just, you know, everything that was screening, I needed to go see. And
you're filling up the hard drive.
I was. And, you know, I mean, like, I'm barely talking about NYU because my time there was just like, yeah, I go to class, get out, and then I can go to the movies.
What did you learn there?
You know, not a lot.
But any practical skills? Shooting? You got to shoot, right?
Yeah, but I immediately, it's one of those things, like, it's like learning math.
Right.
In middle school, I just am like, oh, I won't use this.
Right.
Like, I don't want to be the cinematographer.
Right.
Even though I'm learning how to load a camera.
Yeah.
This doesn't speak to me. I want to work with someone who loves this.
And it'll be obsolete soon. Anyway.
Yeah. It was just, I liked the writing teachers a lot. There was this great professor there who's still there, I think, named Karl Bardosh.
Yeah.
Who's like a Hungarian intellectual.
Yeah.
And he turned me on to some very strange Eastern European cinema that at the time I'd never heard of.
Uh-huh.
Like Sergei Parajanov. And at the time, you know, Kieslowski, which was unknown to me.
And as a writing professor, what did you glean that you took with you?
Not a whole lot. I mean, you know, like, it's a wasteful system. Like, what I always say in terms of the progression out of school into my first movie, which cost $15,000 and we shot it in 1 week. Like, my senior thesis film was a 20-minute, $20,000 film.
Yeah.
And I was the cheapest one in my class.
Yeah.
And everyone kind of spent... Now, some people are spending $50,000.
What was that called?
The first movie is called Impolex. Yeah.
Impolex.
So that wasn't made in school, though. So, but you know, what you're learning
what
is
What was
like,
the thesis movie?
It was like a very Leo, like, you know, Leo New Wave-inspired movie about a young guy in New York who loves older women.
Uh-huh.
And what they teach you is basically like spend $50,000 on a short, have a feature based on the short, and then if the short's good, you can go to Hollywood and you'll make the feature for $5 million.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought into that. And then within a couple years, like 1 year of graduating, you know, like our mutual friend Joe Swanberg is making $5,000 movies.
He's also making 5,000 movies.
Yeah. Well, at the time, only three or four.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm at Kim's and I'm seeing DVDs from people my age. And Sean Williams, my DP, who worked at Kim's as well, shot this movie called Frownland.
Yeah.
Which was like, I mean, that movie is like Sex Pistols at Manchester for a lot of filmmakers in New York.
Oh, yeah.
Like seeing that movie, if you've never seen it, I think you would probably really like it.
Yeah.
It's just like so aggressive and so raw. And seeing that, all of us, we were like, we can do this. Like everyone who saw that movie just like became a filmmaker immediately.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, I have no excuse. I can't make a $5 million movie based on my thesis. I can make a $10,000 movie in 6 days.
Yeah.
That's what everyone's doing now. And then I just set off to do that. And then we did it like a year later because all the people like Joe and Lynn, again, like all these mutual friends now were coming up at the same time and spending more than $5,000 or $10,000 on a movie and spending more than 8 days shooting it was unthinkable. Why would you do that? There's no reason. Like, you can do it. You can do it. So why not?
Well, I mean, I guess in the long run, that prudence and practicality helps you
beyond anything.
Yeah, but I mean, it is nice to have more money and more time, isn't it?
It's nice now.
Yeah,
but you know, it's like if you grew up poor, your family could split a can of soup for 2 days.
Yeah.
And
it's
not preferable.
Survival.
But you know that you won't die.
Yeah.
And if you make a feature for $10,000, $15,000, and then you make another one for $25,000, and then you make one for $1 million,
yeah,
you feel like you have everything in the world.
Right.
And, you know, I still know people that think you can't do this for that budget. And it's like, I did this for $20,000.
Yeah. But do you look back at those films and see... Are there things that, you know, in the earlier movies where you're like, that was really a better movie than my $1 million movie?
No.
Yeah.
I mean, there's that kind of purity in there, which is to say you're making them for no reason. Like, you're not making them because you want to get into the industry. You're making them because you must. You want to get your friends together and just shoot something.
But when did that change for you? I mean, like, when did you, I mean, because your industry is specific. I mean, you are in a world of independent film. You're not... You know, gunning to make, you know, big budget movies necessarily.
No, not at the moment. I'm gunning to write them.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it just because there's nothing else I could offer. It's not like I'm doing this as a hobby.
Well, what was the first feature about? What were the decisions around it?
Of Impelect?
Yeah.
It was inspired by Gravity's Rainbow.
Did you finish Gravity's Rainbow?
Oh, yeah. And the second I put it down, I thought, I don't think I'll grapple with this book or finish thinking about it until I spend a year making my own response to this.
So, really?
Yeah, I mean, like,
I couldn't get through it.
Yeah,
I feel bad about it.
It changed everything for me.
I can get through, you know, Crying of What 49.
Yeah, I love that.
I got through Vineland. I got through. Yeah, I mean, like, I like him.
There's a mode of his that you prefer. You like the more contemporary.
Well, it's just like it was so daunting and it was such a challenge and like, you know, I got to stay focused for that long.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it took me a whole summer to read. But then it changed everything, and I immediately knew that I should leave my job at Kim's and get my friends together and make this movie about rockets because, you know, just like as a sort of artistic response.
The opening line is about missiles, right?
Yeah. Screaming comes across the sky.
Yeah.
The last line's great. Now everybody. Uh-huh. That's what you missed when you didn't get to the end. Perfect last line.
Well, I like the summary.
Yeah. And then there's a bunch of stuff in the middle of those two lines, too. But yeah, I just was like, as a sort of, you know, I mean, it's basically an experimental film.
Yeah.
And it only really played at festivals with the word underground in the title.
Yeah.
But I just had to do
it. Feature length?
Yeah. It's 73 minutes.
Yeah.
I just had to do it. I had to make my response to this piece of work that had influenced me so much. And it was fun. And then I got to go to festivals and I met tons of people that I had never known. I knew Joe at this point already. Right. Sorry, I'm getting a real slip there. There's no one less Jewish than Joe Swanberg.
That's true. But he's a great guy.
And oh, yeah.
I like working
totally
with him.
Supportive. But I knew him already. And then just going to festivals and meeting tons of other filmmakers, I immediately wanted to make another movie so that I could be back at festivals meeting more filmmakers.
And what was the second movie?
It's called The Color Wheel.
Yeah.
It's the only one of my movies that I'm in.
I mean, that's the one about the family?
It's a brother-sister road trip movie.
Oh, it is. Who's in that?
It's me.
Yeah.
And then this actress named Carlin Altman.
I saw you in Joshi, right?
That's right. I'm in Jeff Baena's movie, Joshi.
Yeah, I like that movie.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun to make.
Yeah. So The Color Wheel. So that, like, what compelled you?
Again, like, it was from novels. I was reading a lot of Philip Roth at the time.
Mm.
And just, like, with Pynchon, I thought, I need to write my response to what these novels make me feel.
Which are the Zuckerberg novels or the other ones?
It was really The Professor of Desire that gave me that movie,
because
Carlin's character is moving out of living with her professor.
Okay.
And
see, it's so, like, this is like for me, like, you know, when you talk about French intellectuals, people, you know, actors reading philosophy and, you know, and Philip Roth, it's like it's a real kind of like, you know, 70s Jewish intellectual trip.
I know. That's my, you know, a tweed jacket, corduroy pants.
I love Roth, man. I read the shit out of him, and I still do.
It was so important. I want to start rereading some of his books.
But, have you read all of them?
Well, I have read them all but one because...
Which one?
I've not read Exit Ghost.
Oh, really?
Yeah, with filmmakers and novelists who have a big body of work that I love, I kind of like to have one thing that...
You hold out on?
Yeah, just like for when I'm 50, I can have one new Philip Roth book to read.
Yeah, I think I read that one. I think I read all the later ones. And Sabbath Theater.
That's my favorite.
Right?
Yeah, that book is phenomenal.
Freddie Sabbath, right?
Mickey
is
Sabbath.
That Mickey Sabbath, yeah.
Yeah. Jacking off on the grave of his deceased lover. I mean, it's perverse. And I'm reading these
It's an outlier, too.
Yeah, it's a one-off.
No, yeah.
I'm reading these on the subway, and I'm just thinking, like, the sickness in these... These are bestsellers in their time.
Yeah.
And I'm reading these on the train, and I feel like people are going to look at me.
Like you're dirty.
And I want to write a movie that's kind of like that. So it's this weird kind of, you know, sexual repressed id, you know, Jewish bickering sibling movie that ends with incest.
Great.
Yeah, exactly.
Sort of like Spanking the Monkey.
Very much so, yeah. Or House of Yes as well. It's like, again, like, this is 2010 that we're making it, but it's trying for me. I'm trying to make one of those like classic 90s, like it's black and white 16mm, one of those indie movies that when I was 13, 14, I would read about at Sundance and be like, oh, like an indie movie about incest. That sounds cool. And,
right. Like those movies like Stranger Than Paradise.
Yeah. Which was very important to me. I mean, again, like when I was in NYU, like discovering Jarmusch.
Yeah.
Like it was just not what I wanted to do. Like I didn't want to. Be doing like his style wasn't speaking to me,
but he mixes it up,
yeah. But I was never like, what I want to do is like very dry, deadpan movies where the camera never moves. Yeah. I just loved the identification of his work as a pure artist.
It's so funny. One thing I remember, a quote of him, when I must have read it in a film magazine back in the day. Like, remember his movie Mystery Train?
Yeah.
That when the Japanese tourists are unpacking their luggage in their hotel room, you know, he shoots it, you know, how they've packed. Mm-hmm. And in an interview, he said, you know, I wanted the packing of the luggage, the way the stuff was in the bag, to look like a like one of those little transistor radios when you pull the back off of it.
Interesting, yeah.
Like, I just thought, like, oh, man, that's, like, you know, really attentive, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, but again, like, just seeing that detail in his work, like, just knowing that there are artists behind these bodies of work was very exciting to me.
Well, yeah, and that you can make, you know, you have complete control of the frame to a degree, so you can make these decisions. And, like, you know, the, I guess the spectrum of that goes from, like, you know, somebody who's, you know, totally loose, like Swanberg, to, like, you know, Wes Anderson, that is, like, everything's like a goddamn, you know, little, you know, what do you call those boxes? Where,
yeah,
you
like
know,
a picture box.
Yeah,
yeah, I mean, at this time, you know, I was so, these two movies, you know, the visual style at this point is just developing because I've shot both of them on 16 millimeter.
So you got to be a little economical, huh?
Well, very much so. But also now suddenly there's this aesthetic that I didn't even really think about where the movies feel very timeless, very 70s or 80s or 90s.
Well, you know, I thought that the Queen of Earth felt kind of organic.
Yeah, that's so then by so for Listen Up Philip onward up into Her Smell, the movies were all shot on Super 16.
But like what struck me about it, and I watched the Philip movie, and that's more of that the kind of romanticizing the novelist of the 70s.
Very much so, yeah.
Yeah. But I liked it. I like him, and I like the old cranky guy.
Jonathan Pryce.
Yeah, yeah.
An amazing guy, great actor. And
really a great actor.
Really fun to make that movie. I mean, that was amazing because, you know, again, my Color Wheel was $25,000.
Right.
And now I have just under $1 million. Having, you know, $900,000 after $25,000, I mean, I felt like the richest man in the world. I felt like what I could do on this movie, it expanded by, you know,
well, I think it's
by a whole, you know, just a big bang of resources. And,
but you still strike me as somebody who's going to use that money well. That
you
in the sense that, like, what does this enable me to do relative to what I want to see?
Yeah, and it's and also most importantly, it's I'm bringing all the same people from the smaller movies.
Yeah,
same DP has shot all six of my movies from Impelex, and like I said,
still
we worked at Kim's together, so we go back.
But that's interesting because you know the quality, you know, you do. You know, you clearly have control over, you know, what you want us to see. And but it's not stylistically the same.
Movie to movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's just for me, like I love, even though I'm talking about like, oh, I love you. You can tell a Kubrick movie right away. Like, but, you know, what's the connection visually between 2001 and The Shining?
Like, no, right.
Everything, but also nothing. Just to make a different movie every time.
There's something about the way he moves a camera.
Always,
that's
always
consistent.
The same, but yeah. The milieu of the movie and the style changes based on what the material is.
Sure.
And I find that, you know, that or like even more recently, like, you know, a guy like Soderbergh, you just want to do something different. You don't want to say like,
once you get the skill set, why not mix it up?
Yeah. So I want to do like a big sprawling literary kind of sad comedy like Philip and then do a claustrophobic 70s style thriller like Queen of Earth. And then make a kind of Romer-esque movie like Golden Exits, like, and then make a huge neon glittery rock. It's just like,
yeah,
it's just so much fun for me to challenge this wonderful crew that has made all these movies with me.
Yeah,
to say
and keep it fresh.
We must do something different at all times.
And like, well, the Queen of Earth in terms of like it's, but it's a thriller in the artistic sense of what thrillers used to be.
The loosest sense of the word.
Right, but it's a psychological thriller.
Yeah.
So it's not like, you know, you're not going to find out who the killer is at the end.
Yeah, I always said that if the movie ended with someone being stabbed, it would have made $1 million.
Right.
But no, it's not about that. It's about a psychological breakdown of one woman who just in close up.
Right, and but, you know, it becomes clear two-thirds of the way through the movie that maybe some of what you've been seeing might be from her point of view and not, you know, honestly happening.
100%. And it's fun because, like, you know, I don't know if you've ever done something like this where you kind of feel like it's time to go back to basics.
Uh-huh.
But we made Impelex, like I said, in one house in 1 week for $15,000. And then we made Queen of Earth in one house in 2 weeks. Joe produced this movie, and this was when Joe was starting his production fund.
Yeah.
You know, for a quarter of what Listen Up Philip cost.
Yeah.
But it was fun to take these famous actors and go make a movie basically exactly how we made my first movie. And then just say, you know, we're all going to go up to this house.
Where was it?
It was in Poughkeepsie, kind of near Poughkeepsie.
Yeah.
Carmel, New York.
Yeah.
And just, you know, we have the house. We have the house next door. And we shoot. And it's 2 weeks. And
scripted?
Yeah. That was like a 70-page script because after Listen Up, Philip, I knew that Lizzie Moss, I knew that she brought a lot of ideas that kind of sparked a tangent.
How'd you meet her? Because you seem a little obsessed with her.
Well, we've done three movies. I mean, just really through casting on Philip.
Uh-huh.
Like Jason was in.
Yeah.
And then I got a list of, you know, these are some actresses that would be available at this time. And I saw her and I thought, wow, she'd be amazing in this. All I can think of is her in Mad Men and Top of the Lake.
Yeah.
If she wants to come make this Brooklyn literary sad comedy, that would be really exciting. Her and Jason, that'd be a fun couple.
But at some point you realize that she is, you know, she has multitudes within her.
On that set, I mean, right away on day three or four, I just was like, oh,
Philip.
Yeah, she's firing on all cylinders. And then 6 months later, sent her a 70-page script for Queen of Earth. And
but
said,
Queen of Earth is like, that's a taxing exercise for an actress.
Yeah.
And you were completely sort of, I imagine, like thrilled and curious to see how far she could take it.
Very much so. And just very trusting and doing whatever we could to give her that, shoot the movie in order. Let her, you know, she...
Oh, you would have to, huh?
Yeah, we shot it in order from start to finish. And, you know, that was her first producing credit that she wanted to transition into learning that side of things. And
I really like the movie. And I'm very proud of it.
Of Queen of Earth.
Yeah. Yeah, because, like, you know, it made me realize some things in terms of writing, because, you know, I'm writing with Lynn. And, like, there, in terms of, you know, what how are you going to serve this story and what is the story and, you know, how do you overserve it? Like the bare
essentials.
Right.
You know, what can you do in a house where all you have is two great actresses, a camera, and a naturally nice location?
Yeah.
What, like, you can do something with that. And, you know, Joe, I don't know if you saw Joe's movie, Happy Christmas.
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
Like, this was trying to apply that model. They have basically the exact same budget. You know, Joe was like, we're in this weird position where after Drinking Buddies and after Listen Up, Philip, we could get like the same kind of actors that want to come make $1 million indie to make $100,000 indie with us now because actors know that we're fun to work with. So if he's like, I got Anna Kendrick after Drinking Buddies to come make a $100,000 movie, you can do the same with Lizzie Moss.
Well, the funny thing is that, like, you know, I talked to Stephen Dorff yesterday.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
He was so good on the new True Detective.
So good.
Somewhere is one of my favorite movies.
It's great. But, you
a
know,
really,
like,
really great movie.
You know, but like in True Detective, I'm watching him like, this is like, it's like he's like reborn or something. Like, it's like,
as I felt in Somewhere, he's always impressive whenever he comes into one of these huge roles.
And the point being is that, like, you know, at some point we're talking and he's like, you know, I'll come in and read. I love to act.
Yeah.
So, like, if you give these talented people, you know, something that they can really, you know, get, you know, cut loose in, they've got to be thrilled.
And, you know, as we've learned, like, and as you've known from working with Lynn or Joe, like, sometimes this is a week of time, 2 weeks.
Listen to that noise.
What is that? Is that Glendale Construction?
That's my fucking yard guy.
Do you schedule him to come when you have someone on?
Well, I mean, I don't, I'm not that organized.
Yeah.
Hold on a minute. Maybe if I shut the blinds.
I couldn't hear it until you said anything.
No, I know. It's sorry.
We have stuff like this in Queen of Earth where there's like the yard guy outside.
Yeah, he's got the same piece of equipment that guy out there.
You hear those machines and they just drive you nuts.
Oh my God, it sounds like that's in the fucking room.
It's pretty loud now.
Let's give him a minute.
You couldn't go outside and ask him to move to the other side of the house?
Well, I mean, it's like, you know, it's a finite zone there. You know, I mean, he doesn't, you know, eventually...
Is he mowing or just like...
No, it's blowing.
What is the point of that?
To get the leaves and dust off of shit.
But where do they go? They just go into the sidewalk or the street?
No, they put them in a bag.
Oh, okay, so they get sucked up.
Well, no, they don't suck them up. They usually blow them into an organized pile, and then they put them in a bin.
It's so crazy. What a waste of energy. Why don't you just get a rake? This is crazy to me that this is like a... There's a guy on my street.
I mean, it's sort of an advance, though. I mean, you know, at some point, you know, someone said, like, this raking's taking a long time, and this is a more efficient way to do it.
Yeah, it only takes, like, $1,000 device with lots of energy and, like, battery power. And
I think it's that these guys usually use the gas ones. But, yeah, I mean, I understand your argument.
There's a guy on my street that just walks
around.
You're
saying return to the rake?
I just, you know, there's a guy on the street that walks around with, like, a blower just blowing, you know, trash and leaves and dust off of the sidewalk. And it's just like, how is this better than a broom?
I get it, but like, how is it better? It's a little more fun.
It's not for me, not for us inside. It's more fun for the guy.
Yeah, of course, but it's a labor intensive. These guys got to move on. Yeah. You know, they can't, you know, be spending all day with the rake. And there's not that much to rake. It's really just, you know, it's maintenance, dude. But I understand your argument. You know, this is like, you know, that the
rake. I like old things. I like shooting on film.
The rake is 16 millimeters.
Yeah, exactly. I like things that are simple. I like to read a book. I don't have a Kindle.
Yeah, analog. Yeah, me too. I like to read a book.
I like brooms. I don't like gas powered.
I'm with you too. Forward. Like, I do the broom thing. And then
you're a broom guy?
Yeah, I got a broom downstairs. But I also have vacuums. But like sometimes, like I don't even think. I don't think there's another option than the broom. And somehow the woman that cleans my house every so often, like she's doing something else that seems much more efficient.
Yeah.
But do you live in a house?
We have half of a brownstone.
That's nice.
But as we were discussing, much like you, I have three cats.
Yeah.
House gets dirty.
Yeah, it gets fucking, everything's covered.
And ours
are
all long haired.
Look at what you're sitting on. If you sit up.
Cats love this kind of seat.
It's covered with hair.
Yeah, no, we have a kitchen table with cushions like this, and the black and white cat sit on opposite sides of it.
What you have to accept with a cat is just crazy. I mean, my bedspread is covered with litter dust.
Yeah, and I couldn't care less. I'm happy to have that. I'd rather have that than not the cats. But, you know, the house gets dirty.
And then there's the throwing up.
Yeah. It's weird. The three cats we have now are not barfers.
Mine aren't usually, but one of them will do it occasionally.
Yeah, one of our cats that we don't have anymore would throw up like two or three times a week, kind of like seemingly as a prank, like to get us up out of bed. But we don't have a lot of barf at the moment.
So you're doing a lot of thinking and making these movies.
Yeah, more than I think you would think because they feel loose. Like they're not like...
But does anyone outside of you... I'm sorry to interrupt.
You don't have to apologize.
But does anyone outside of you pick most of this shit up?
Not really. Because
there's no critics like that anymore, dude.
Yeah, it's weird. It's weird. You would think, like, it's not that I'm dismayed because if someone likes the movie, great. But the movies are loose by design. Handheld camera work, dialogue that is scripted to feel unscripted.
Yeah.
And people look at it and they think it's all made up. They don't understand the intricacy of some of the things that we really work on. And
well, you're loading them up.
They just feel loose to people, which is great. They are loose, but they're loose meticulously, especially the new one. You know, it's not like what Wes would do with the
frame.
Yeah, but it's not dissimilar. I mean, we're putting thought into all these
things. No, I know. And there was a time where, you know, these clues and these hints and these, you know, the people that used to write about film when you were like the people that saw all the movies that you saw and were writing about those films in the day, you know, all the Youngblood, Saris, you know, like the people that would really take it apart, you know, like the semiotics guys, like they would find these things. It used to be like a goal, I think. It was to sort of wonder whether or not you knew that these things were there.
Yeah, and to be the first one to kind of catch on and say, you know.
I don't know. I don't read much writing like that about film. I imagine it's out there. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, of course people are working in that model, but the problem is like, at least with, you know, there's like criticism and then there's like critical writing.
Right.
Like a review of a movie at a film festival, the movie premieres at 8 p.m. and the review is out by midnight.
Yeah.
I mean, that's garbage. Like there's no quality to that. And, you know, I read these reviews, you know, Her Smell has these five long scenes. Five is an easy number to count to. You can do it on one hand.
Yeah.
And then I read these reviews the morning after in Toronto. The movie has four scenes. The movie has six scenes.
Yeah.
And it's like...
Five.
I would assume critics could count to five. Like this is galling to me that you would not only miss that, but that you would then put it in writing and not even like say to your editor, "Can you check with the film's publicist if this movie has four or six scenes?"
Also, they don't do their homework. They're sloppy. They don't give a fuck. Yeah. You know, like they misspell things. It's just a nightmare. Like even just like with people interviewing me or writing about something, how many times I have to call back and say like, "I definitely did not say this."
And like they take your words out of context.
They just misquote.
Yeah,
like it's like I know what I said. You know, and it wasn't that person or that was not the reference I made, and this doesn't make any sense.
Interesting.
Can you just change it? Because I don't mind that you're putting the whole conversation as I talk to you, but it's like, get this point right.
Do you read those things about yourself?
Not usually. Sometimes they come down the pike and I'll read them like interviews because sometimes like I'm surprised at, you know, that I'm making sense because I talk so fucking much sometimes.
And then you want to see how people kind of...
Well, I want to see how it looks on the page because I didn't put it there.
Yeah. No, I mean, I love stuff like that too. I'm more likely to read an interview that I did than read a review of the movie at this point.
Yeah, because like you want to see how your brain's working. I mean, I know like talking to you that you're receiving what I'm saying and we're having a conversation. But if someone's asking me questions and I'm like caffeinated and it's the morning and I'm on the phone and I'm just going, sometimes I like to look at what that looks
and
like.
And also, it's impossible to overstate this. Like, again, we're here. Despite the noise outside, like, this is as nice as it gets for a conversation. When I do an interview and I'm at a cafe.
Yeah.
Around the corner from my house.
Yeah, it's worse.
And there's people around, and I feel like I can't really speak honestly because then I sound like an asshole to the person sitting next to me.
Yeah.
Like,
but also you're dealing with set questions too. Like, there's limited engagement. There's a guy that's nervous or he's done it a million times and he's got two questions that he's really think are going to nail the thing.
Yeah, and then I kind of, you know, you have to be quiet. Maybe you happen to get to the cafe during the 1 hour that no one else is talking and everyone is drinking coffee and reading.
And then eventually you develop a pattern around these things. You do enough of these interviews and, you know, you find like you're giving roughly this. Oh, hold on. It's a third noise.
Yeah, there's like now it's like a mower. This is great. This is great. Great material.
I apologize.
With the headphones on, you can barely. It can't be picking up on the microphones, right?
Maybe a little. I mean, this is like a little bit much. Paul Rudd and I did an improvisation around the noises. We did.
I can't rise to that occasion.
We did sort of a throat singer of Tuva homage.
Yeah, like Yaima in the movie, which does throat singing.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yes.
Forget about like the same. I mean, this is so pleasant because like. I'm a fan and we're having this conversation, but I did 2 hours of phone interviews yesterday and probably 75% of each one were the same answers, the same words, the same questions.
Yeah, and you got to do it. But okay, so look, here's my experience with the new film, which I liked. Because I read, you know, the parts of the script at least that, you know, I was going to, you know, possibly audition for.
Mm-hmm. Or according to your representation that was yours already.
Yeah. Stoltz played it, and he did good. He did it very differently than I would have done it.
Which is interesting because at the time of your name coming up, I hadn't seen Glow yet.
Oh, yeah.
Because I watch everything 6 months after everyone else does.
Yeah.
And then when I watched it, right after we wrapped, because I watched all of Gail's scenes when we were interested in her. I mean, the show is phenomenal.
Oh, good.
Like, I loved it so much.
Thanks.
And you're so good on it. Like, it's just a remarkable show.
Thank you.
There's a pattern to the character of a guy like that.
Yeah.
You can do it 100 different ways.
Yeah.
You can be the guy who's sweating bullets. You can be the guy who's got an ulcer tearing in his belly. And you can be the guy who's Mr. Cool.
Yeah.
It's just so fun to think about something like that, which on the page, I don't know that until an actor comes in and tells me their take on it.
Well, I mean, I think my instincts would have like, you know, the interesting thing about those characters, and I think that Stoltz in the movie played it a little Hollywood, which was that there was sort of a fundamental kind of detachment and an active engagement in, you know, being sort of seemingly a friend or a mentor. But, you know, underlying it all was that, you know, he's a business guy.
Very much so. And also, as people pointed out, once we were doing it, kind of an enabler.
Yeah,
of
course.
Of her, which is something that
they all are.
Oh, very much so.
Yeah.
Which is very important to understanding the sort of patterns of dealing with an addict, which, you know, the movie's very much about. But the extent to which he enables that character wasn't really apparent until we were doing the scenes, because by playing it cool as a cucumber Hollywood guy, I've got this figured out, then he's the one who just kind of lets her get away with it.
And lets her get away with it and rolls the dice on the talent's well-being, because the talent, their job is to manipulate the talent into continuing to, you know, be a money funnel, really, and to try to, you know, maintain some sort of you don't want to kill the person, but you do turn a blind eye to certain things if they're still earning.
Of course. And, you know, I have this with people in my creative orbit. We all have this. Someone that's like, I can't really cut this person out because I need them or I really value them and they're maybe the best at what they do and they're very important to me.
Yeah.
But part of that means you just kind of, you get what you get.
Yeah.
And then you have to, the job is learning to work around those eccentricities.
Why this story, though? You know, like, this story has been, you know, it's been attempted, it's been done. You know, it's tricky to create a fake rock band that is supposedly a huge rock band.
Yeah.
You know, like I the movie that keeps hitting my brain with it was that movie, I think it was called Gloria, with Jennifer Jason Leigh and Holly.
Yeah, interesting. That's a pull.
Who directed it? Was it Uwe Gospard, I think, maybe? And it was about sisters.
Right, right.
One was a folk singer, and Jennifer Jason Leigh was the sister who was the punk rock drug addict. Yeah.
No one's brought that up.
Oh,
We generally talk a lot about.
Did you see that movie? You know what I'm talking
about? Yeah, I do know what you're talking about. We generally talk about, Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains.
Uh-huh.
You know that movie?
No.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, it's a great movie.
Yeah.
It's like a 16-year-old Diane Lane and Laura Dern.
Okay.
For these teenage girls that start a punk band.
Yeah.
And Paul Cook and Steve Jones from the Sex Pistols and Paul Simonon from The Clash are this other like British punk band that they're touring with. And, and Jones and Cook wrote the music for the movie. It's a great fake punk band movie.
Interesting.
But yeah, I mean, I'd wanted to make a music movie, and I tried to make one a few years ago that didn't happen, set in the 60s.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, this was my time, and I kind of came up with this character for Lizzie, and there has not been the 90s alternative movie, the 90s grunge movie, the 90s punk movie. And I'm as far away from it, both in time and also as close to it in my own life as like Todd Haynes and Velvet Goldmine.
Right.
That's 97. Yeah. That's looking back at about 74, 75.
God, you're really doing the math.
I got really into numbers on this, as Jason pointed out at the Q&A last night. But, you know, like, you make it about your thing. You know, if I did a 60s movie, it's like, yeah, I mean, I wasn't there. I just love this music.
But, you know, but I do have to accept on some level that, you know, this is a meditation on that.
Very much so. It's not, you know, I have no interest in doing the true story of something.
Yeah.
Because as a writer, then you're boxed in.
Yeah.
You can only do so much if you're at reality that closely. So just kind of taking a 25-year step back from the era I loved, the women and rock that I loved, the CDs that I loved. You know, I talked about being inspired by Gravity's Rainbow or Professor of Desire, to be inspired by a CD.
Yeah, and you liked my talk with Tanya.
Tanya Donnelly, that was a great talk. You had Kim and Kelly Deal on.
Sure.
That was great as well.
I think I just had Kim on.
Really? Oh, really? I thought it was both.
No.
I wonder why I thought that.
She probably talked about it. Yeah.
You were there for a lot of this.
I remember seeing The Throwing Muses when I was in college.
Present tense music.
Yeah, no, I thought you definitely hit a lot of the chords, like, you know, story-wise and, you know, and musically about what it would be like. And they're, like, the scenes that really, like, it's interesting to me that you see this as fundamentally, you know, it's your music movie, but your focus was, it's about drug addiction.
It is, but it's not a drug movie. You know, it's not.
Well, no, you went out of your way. You don't really see her do drugs.
By design. Because,
I know, I felt that.
Because then you're boxed into, like, oh, well, if she just did that, then she should be acting this way.
Well, no, and also, like, it also leaves open for the fact, is she having a manic break? I mean,
much is she even doing?
And, like, and is this, you know, relative to her fame and her ego? Is it, you know, relative to a bipolar disposition? Because you were pretty careful outside of her taking a couple slugs of booze, you know, not to, you know, really sort of, you know, get into the nuts and bolts.
Oh, she ducks into the bathroom.
Blow or dope. Yeah,
she goes into the back room, and Lizzie and Agnes Dean, who plays Mari, her kind of, you know, her bass player and drug partner in the movie.
Well, you see her do drugs.
Yeah. They created a lot of, like, talk to people. They looked at research and, you know, if you take a hit of whatever we're deciding the scene is, where are you at 1 minute later?
Yeah.
Where are you at 20 minutes later? Because this movie, you do have to address if, you know, Mari takes a bump of something. We're still with her 20 minutes later when she's kind of
fidgety.
Yeah, and
she was doing coke.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I guess, like,
as she came up with. But, you know, like, it's not, yeah, I didn't want to do, like, the drug movie or just, like, rise and fall movie. It's more like, as you said, bipolar. This is a movie about seven women who all have these dual personalities. That's what I'm fascinated by in this kind of, you know, the punk persona, you know, calling yourself Sid Vicious when your name is John Beverly.
Yeah, like, I like that part pretty good.
Just the idea that they all have these alter egos, and the whole movie is this push and pull where is she Becky or Rebecca? And then at the end, when you kind of get the payoff of all seven women's real names in the seance, it's like, oh, this is really like, there's a struggle here. You know, even Dirtbag Danny, you know, that's a fake name. Yaima, they call him Alvin.
Like, yeah.
People just create these personas to deal with fame, success, their professional public life, and I think that's really interesting.
Right. So, like, but I the scene, some of the scene moments that really, like, I thought were great was when she was by herself and nodding out or whatever the fuck she decided she was on, where she was just sort of like almost catatonic and repetitive.
Yeah.
But then she pulls out of that, and out of nowhere, you pull a Manson song out of your ass.
That's right. Yeah, I'm glad. I'm glad you caught that. That's the thing. Like, you have to, you know, when you do a movie that's just these long scenes, you have to establish through other means what the deal is with the characters.
Yeah.
You don't ever see Becky's record collection.
Right.
You imagine it's big, but you hear her pull out Manson. You hear her pull out Cockspar.
Yeah.
You hear her reference Iron Maiden.
Yeah.
You know that she just has this brain for things.
And what was the decisions around shooting it? Like, you know, these different sections, all five. I imagine, given the math nature of your creative vision, that you know, you had a specific way of shooting each section.
We did. Well, yes, you surmised correctly. So five acts, each one had a rehearsal day, where day one of the movie, we spent 8 hours rehearsing act one.
Yeah.
No filming.
Right.
Maybe you go
all for, scripted.
All scripted. There's not a word in the final edit that's not on the page. All the references, all the train of thought.
Well, that was the other thing that I noticed at you. It was sort of an amazing thing, and I think an evolution for you was that, you know, some of this stuff was, you know, in the flow of the language was almost Shakespearean, not in the words being used, but, you know, in the way that the lyricism of the words flowed.
I mean, that was the hope, you know, like you read
it's hard to pull off.
It's very hard to pull off. I never doubted that she could do it. You read Shakespeare on the page, it maybe reads like gibberish.
Yeah.
Then you go see a beautiful production and the flow of it makes it logical.
So you were conscious of that.
Yeah. I mean, I was just so inspired, obviously, by classic five-act tragedy structure.
Yeah.
Merchant of Venice and Hamlet were on my mind.
Yeah.
Along with the, at the time of starting to crack the script, the Guns N' Roses reunion tour.
Uh-huh.
That was another good episode.
Yeah.
Slash.
Yeah.
As soon as I saw that, I was like, I need to go for a walk today so I can listen to this.
He was great, right?
But like that tour.
There's another guy that it surprises you that what's beneath the nickname.
Yeah. Saul. Yeah. Like, yeah. Saul and William, two guys, like, that sounds like your accountants, not the, yeah, you know, the singer and the guitar player, the greatest band,
yeah,
of my lifetime. Go have your taxes done by Saul and William. But you know, it's just like, The structure of it was so exciting to me when I kind of cracked that. But then the question was, how do we shoot it?
Yeah.
And we came up with this idea of a rehearsal day where everyone gets to just feel it out, find the choreography. And then each act was 3 days, uh-huh, of shooting, where we would basically shoot 10 pages a day.
Yeah, that's a lot.
It is a lot, but it's one thing.
Yeah.
It's just one long scene. So you do it 8 or 9 times. The first three are just on Lizzie's face.
Yeah.
The next three are behind her.
Yeah.
The next three are getting everyone else in the room. You've done 10, you know, 10 takes 10 times, and you have the whole thing, and then tomorrow you just pick up right where you left off.
But what about the camera work in each separate five of the five?
It's written into the script. You know, I knew,
because the first one is claustrophobic
and all Steadicam.
Yeah,
by design.
Yeah.
I wanted to be right there. I never worked with Steadicam. I was really excited.
Let's celebrate.
It does sound really quiet all of a sudden, but don't jinx it.
Okay.
Knock on wood. I just wanted to learn how to work with Steadicam. The kind of Paul Verhoeven influence of the movie demanded it. And then the second act in the recording studio, do you know Sympathy for the Devil, the, yep, Godard Rolling Stones, yep, movie? It's just these long dollies rolling,
yeah,
around,
I could see that,
zooming,
yeah,
in and out. And we said, if we're in a recording studio, I said to Sean, act two is a recording studio. And he goes, dollies and zooms like Sympathy for the Devil? And I was like, that's what it says on the page. I already wrote those words. And then act three, you know, handheld as crazy as possible, because each time the camera is changing what it's doing, it's just, again, it's just, that's what Becky's head is doing at that, yeah, moment. It's either crazy and flying all over, or it's kind of paranoid and slow.
Yeah.
Or it's just shaky and insane. And then act four, it's just nothing moving, as static as can be.
Yeah.
But it was just a way of writing the shots and saying, yeah, like, the style of this movie changes every 25 minutes.
And the last act?
Goes back to the way the first one was.
Yeah.
Same location, same camera patterns, but now there's this kind of eerie, you know, disembodied quality where she's been sober now for, you know, just a hair under 2 years. And it has this kind of weird dreamlike.
And also, there was a couple of years after whatever happened that implies the sort of hitting of the wall in the film that clearly it went on for a while.
That's
after that.
Very important. I'm glad you noticed that.
Like, yeah.
It says when she's there, you know, I have a year next week. But it's not been a year since the last scene.
Right.
It's obviously anybody who has
And apparently she made a record with that other band during that time. And
And that is kind of addressed later, you know, like, and then. Yeah. But yeah, that's very important that when she says, I have a year, anyone who's ever known anybody knows she didn't get sober the morning after the last scene.
No.
There was stops and starts. And
also, I like the sycophancy of even people who are intimately, like, of her mother and her ex-husband, that, you know, they see what's going on, but, you know, she's been, you know, paying for their lives.
Very much so. And simply, like, you know, we all know this. You just can't get out of some of these relationships. They're your family. They're your creative
partners.
They're
also your cash cow.
And everyone says that about her. Says the golden goose, Gail says this, golden goose who sprays golden piss in our faces.
Yeah.
Like, you want to not have that, but you can't. And you just know, and everyone in the movie, their agony is, our lives are tied to her and we can't help her because she doesn't want help and she won't help herself.
And I like the, you know, the sort of thoughtful, the sort of tenuousness and fragility of, you know, even a year sober is very, you know, dicey.
And to be that and having to go out on stage
for
the first time in years.
Sure.
I have a friend who's sober, and after the movie she said, I've never seen something that so accurately makes it feel like what it is when you have to step out, get in front of people, spotlight in your face. Yeah. But you know, Lizzie looked a lot at like the Amy Winehouse documentary.
Yeah.
Which was, you know, like people were just, every time she was on stage, people were like, is she even going to make it?
Right.
It's weird. She was really into that, and she was really into, did you see Jim and Andy? Uh-uh. The Jim Carrey, Andy Kaufman documentary?
Yeah.
She was really into that for some reason. That kind of like bottled mania really appealed to her for whatever reason.
No, I could see that. Like, she definitely enjoyed from that. Well, great job, buddy.
Thank you so much for watching. I'm so flattered.
Oh, yeah. Why wouldn't I? Of course. And thanks for talking.
Thank you.
And good luck with the with whatever happens with this movie and the next movie.
Thank you.
Okay, folks. That was me and Alex Ross Perry. It was exciting, wasn't it? A lot talked about. I kind of locked into his intensity a bit there. His most recent film, Her Smell with Elizabeth Moss, is available on Apple, Amazon, and other on-demand digital platforms. Okay. All right. I'll be home later today. Okay? I'll be home later today. And I'll talk to you from there. All right. No music. No guitar with me. Okay? Boomer lives!